yesterday there was something coming.
Okay.
Remember, because we asked for a fiscal note on something.
Okay.
Something.
Yeah.
Well, I talked to George.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I rushed yesterday.
I didn't see it on the agenda, so I thought it was off, and now it's back on.
I know. I realized afterwards.
Yeah.
So nobody was really paying attention.
None
of me.
They
won't even hear it.
Division.
And that's why I heard it.
Morning.
Just quickly, you got my note. We're not going to have to.
Posted when I was doing here. It didn't even.
Dude, they told me they'd get done, and then Janice just told me it was coming through the system.
We have like four handouts for everybody. Should we get those to
us? These two we don't have. This one we do at Bethesda.
Right now,
but the rest of them are either appropriations or.
But I mean, if you.
The Senate Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We're taking up some bills today about hospitals and a few other miscellaneous bills. We hope to get through our agenda today. We were not expecting to have to end our meeting at 10 this morning when we scheduled these bills, so my apologies in advance if we don't finish. We're going to begin with Senator Lynch, Senate File 502.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here today to present Senate File 502. And before we get into the merits of the bill, I would like to especially thank my co-authors on this bill, Senator Fischbach, Senator Prettner-Solin, Senator Berglund, and Senator Marty. Senate File 502 eliminates the ratable reductions for Bethesda Hospital, which is the only nonprofit licensed long-term hospital in the state. Bethesda provides care for an average of 125 patients a day, roughly 1,400 patients a year. Long-term care hospitals provide a unique set of services to patients in Minnesota. Patients cannot be admitted to the hospital unless the expected average length of stay is 25 days. In Bethesda's case, the average length of stay is 33 days. This bill guarantees the disproportionate payment adjustment that was passed in 2005. It's important to note that this bill does not provide additional DPA. The department worked with us in preparing this bill and provided technical assistance in drafting the bill. Bethesda is known as a state resource for brain injury services, including the Neural Brain Injury Unit, a respiratory care that successfully weans patients, often with spinal cord injuries, off their ventilators, and a medical behavior unit that has locked and an unlocked unit for geriatric patients that are either a danger to themselves or others and simply cannot be managed in a skilled nursing home facility or at home. With me today are Robert Carroll, and Brian Johnson, and I will allow them to further introduce themselves, but more importantly, talk to you about the specifics of this bill and the importance of these details impacting the rate of reductions and loss and medical assistance. So at this point, I'd like to turn this over to my testifiers, and then we will be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, members, for letting me come testify today. I'm Dr. Bob Carroll. I'm a neuropsychologist, meaning that I'm a psychologist that specializes in people that have had brain injuries. And I've been working at Bethesda for about 14 years now, specializing with people that have had brain injuries. We run specialty programs at Bethesda that are not run elsewhere. And I want to talk specifically about our brain injury programs. We have three programs there. We have a rehabilitation program for people with relatively new injuries. We have a crisis program for people who have had brain injuries and are having behavioral problems. These folks otherwise would end up in psychiatric units, and they're the outliers for the psychiatric units. These are the people who do not do well in traditional psychiatric care. And then we have a program, a long-term program, for people with brain injuries who are clearly dangerous to themselves and other people and have generally failed everybody else's treatment. We specialize in everybody else's treatment failures. We take everybody else's outliers. This is a relatively unique program nationwide. When I travel around the country and give lectures and discuss programming with other people, I have yet to find a program that does what we do with the severity of the people we take. We take people who've had run-ins with the police. We take people that have burned down their group homes. We take people that have assaulted their pregnant mothers. We take people that have threatened to hurt other people. We take people who have threatened to kill their children. We take dangerous people who have had brain injuries and who otherwise no one else would know what to do with. Now, I'm sure you've heard people testify before from other disability groups, representing other disability groups. And I think everyone with a disability deserves excellent care. But I want to give you some numbers to give you a sense of the scope of the problem of brain injury, because I'm sure you hear numbers from everybody, and it's hard to put them into context. If you take all of the people in the United States every year that have had that get new cases of breast cancer, and you take all the people every year that have new cases of spinal cord injury, and you take all the new cases of AIDS and HIV, and you take all the new cases of multiple sclerosis, and you add them all together, brain injury is six times that total number. Six times those added together. There's roughly 1.5 million new traumatic brain injuries. These are just traumatic brain injuries, blows to the head, every year. The numbers are just astounding. The Brain Injury Association of America and the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota refer to this as a silent epidemic. It's happening to huge numbers of people, and nobody's talking about it. Now, most of these people do not end up with the kinds of behavioral problems that I'm going to talk about. But for the small subset that do, no one other than Bethesda knows what to do with these folks. Again, these are everybody else's outliers. These are the folks that have failed everyone else's treatment programs. In about 14 years ago, the state of Minnesota, in conjunction with the Bethesda Hospital, looked at these folks and said, we don't know what to do with them. They're causing all kinds of troubles in the healthcare system. They're overburdening the rest of our systems, the police, the state hospitals, et cetera, and we need to come up with some treatment design for them, and Bethesda put their program into place. We get about 85% of our patients from other hospitals, so we are saving other hospitals from having these people linger unsuccessfully in their programs. Without us, these are the folks that would end up either homeless in the state hospitals or in prison. There's a study going on right now in Minnesota in conjunction with the Department of Corrections looking at the admission of people to the state to the prison system. What they're finding is amazing. 90% of new prison admissions in Minnesota, this is preliminary data, have had at least one brain injury. 60% have had two or more brain injuries. There was a study done for the Minnesota's business plan to end long-term homelessness, quoting Wilder information. They estimate about 31% of homeless people have had brain injuries. So if Bethesda was not there to treat these dangerous people, these are the kinds of places they would end up. They would end up in jail, they would end up homeless, or they would end up in the state hospital and languish in the state hospital system. When we set this program up, we had to come up with a treatment modality to deal with these folks because nothing done previously had worked, and we designed a treatment program called neuropsychosocial intervention. And essentially what we did was we said, all right, we need to understand these people really well so we can design services around each individual person as opposed to forcing them to fit a pre-existing treatment model. This was so unique that we've had a book published by the Chemical Rubber Company Publishing Company, which is a division of Taylor and Francis. This is a company that publishes medical textbooks about our kinds of programs. It's specifically about the treatment modality we've come up with. We are very successful in what we do. Most of the people who go through this program go out into the community successfully. Some go home. Some go to group homes. Some return to work. But we are getting people out of the system into the community successfully. And again, I want to remind you the kinds of people we're taking. They're dangerous. They're threatening other people. They're threatening themselves. And without us, they would end up burdening the rest of the system. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there any questions? I would say, based on your testimony, if there's anyone on this committee that is undecided about mandatory seatbelts, maybe you will have changed their mind.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Brian Johnson, the Director of Finance at Bethesda Hospital, to add a few additional brief remarks.
Good morning, and I also appreciate the chance to talk to this committee today. I'm just going to focus on a couple of items that should be in the handout, which was included in your brochure this morning. The third page of that handout shows a list of where Bethesda takes its patients from. And as Dr. Carroll mentioned a few minutes ago, about 85% of our patients come from other acute hospitals. What further elaboration will indicate is that many of these patients come from areas beyond the metropolitan area. We do get a sizable number of our admissions from the Rochester area, from the St. Cloud area, from the Duluth area, and even from counties in western Wisconsin. Bethesda really is a regional asset. The first page of that handout should have two equal yellow lines near the bottom. And what I would like to point out here is the impact of the ratable reductions that were put in 2003 and 2005. Hopefully everybody has that handout. No?
It's inside this brochure.
It's in the... You hopefully have a brochure that looks like this, and then there are three pages inside that. The top page of that handout should have two yellow lines on it that are of equal length. The impact of the ratable reduction on Bethesda is the difference between the bottom line and the first two columns. It's just over $100 a day. But about 80 to 85% of our patients fall into the first category, and that's about $100 a day. So Bethesda has typically about 5,000 medical assistance paid days each year. So at 5,000 days times $100 a day times 85%, you can see that the impact of the ratable reduction to Bethesda was about $4 million a year. The second page of the handout also has two yellow lines, but they're not of the same length. And what I'd like to point out here is that the yellow line that says DRG 429, now DRG 429 is defined as organic disturbance and mental retardation. Most of the patients Dr. Carroll sees fall into that category. We had, over the course of the last 2.5 years, 22 admissions into Dr. Carroll's neurobehavioral program, NBI program. Those are the extreme cases that he was referring to. Of those 22 cases, 19 fell into this category, 429. The average length of stay of those patients he sees is over 200 days. As Senator Lynch mentioned earlier, Bethesda's overall average is only 33 days. Your typical acute hospital is about 5 days. So the people he is seeing are in our hospital on the average from 6.5, 7 months. This table also shows that Bethesda loses about $300 a day on those patients, and you can do the math on that. What we're not asking for this group or in File 502, we're not asking to have the entire loss Bethesda has covered. That's about $700 a day. But in working with the Department of Human Services, what we're trying to eliminate is just the loss within this program, which is about $300 a day. And hopefully these two bills will cover that loss. Now, we are a single rate pay, so whatever rate increase we would get would cover all of our programs. But his program is the lowest cost program we do have. And if we can just eliminate the loss on that program, then we really do have the partnership that we set out to 14 years ago. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, are the numbers that you're showing us numbers before rebasing?
Yes, these numbers are from a study that we first gave to the department last summer. So these are carryover numbers from our fiscal year, which is August.
And so how will you be affected by rebasing?
Rebasing in January, how we get paid is about every 4 years the state will adjust our rates based on a recent cost report that has been audited. Through December, that cost report was our 1999 cost report. Effective January, we are now to be paid based on our 2003 cost report. And we had estimated that the impact of the 2003 cost report would be about $200 a day. But that's still based on our 2003 cost report.
Right. So how much will that close the gap that you're trying to close with this bill?
I estimate that on the first column on the front page, which is at 918, that number will go up to about just a little over 1,100. And that the second column, which is at 1,028, that number will go up to about 1,250. However, on the second page, if you go back to the second page and look at the yellowed column, our expense per day last year was 1,321. So those two increases for the rebasing still won't cover what our expense was last year. It will narrow the gap.
And so really what I'm trying to figure out without having a calculator here is what's the difference between what this bill would do for you and what rebasing is doing for you?
And I don't have a calculator either, but we can we can roughly say that if the first column goes to 1,118 and the second column goes to 1,251, but 80 to 85% of our patients are in the lower paid category, we're probably in the 1,130 range, and our cost is 1,321 last year. We're still $200 short.
And were you trying to make up all of that with this bill?
Yes. And also knowing that when we were rebased effective January based on our 2003 cost report, it will be several years before it will be rebased again.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, I'll just end by saying again or reiterating that the uniqueness in this bill and the focus on Bethesda, again, is that this is and should really be viewed as a very unique resource for the entire state of Minnesota. Thank you.
And we do have a fiscal note for your bill today, so people can take a look at it. Unfortunately, David is not here. He's running around getting other fiscal notes that aren't ready yet. But if people have any questions, the department is here who helped put the fiscal note together. Any questions? Right. If not, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 502 be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, the motion is that Senate File 502 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members.
Thanks for the good work you do, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair. It's good to be back. At this time, I'd like to present Senate File 635, and I would invite my testifiers to come forward and join me at the table. Before we begin the discussion on Senate File 635, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. I believe that that has been distributed. And simply puts the bill in the form that we want to discuss today. With that, I would move adoption of the A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment is attached to the back of the bill, members. And the fiscal note does reflect the language in the amendment. Are there any questions? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And again, I'd like to begin by thanking my co-authors on this bill, Senators Berglund, Pretner, Solon, Coring, and Rosen. Senate File 635 has been introduced simply because I'm very concerned, as I know many of you at the table are today, about the level of cuts that have been made over the last 5 years in payments to our hospitals when they are caring for individuals in our state health care programs. I think that it's a challenge that as much as we are all collectively working together to move forward, in so many cases, arguably in too many cases, we are working to simply reinstate some of the ground that has been lost in recent years. Payment reductions to hospitals were made in 2002, 2003, and 2005. To date, direct cuts to hospitals have totaled over $293 million. Unfortunately, one budget cut did not replace previous budget cuts. The cuts are cumulative, piling one on top of the other, adding more and more savings for the state and more pain to our hospitals and the patients that they serve. In addition, the direct payment cuts imposed by the state, hospitals have been our safety net, caring for more and more individuals who are uninsured or underinsured. Between 2003-2004, hospital uncompensated care grew by 25%, and that was further followed in 2004-2005 at a rate of 28%. Contrary to what many people think, Minnesota's spending for hospital care for those in our public health care programs is not overly generous. According to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, in its June 2006 publication entitled How Does Minnesota Compare?, Minnesota's state spending on health care and hospitals was ranked 35th in the nation on a per capita basis and 41st in the nation per $1,000 of income. I think that helps to kind of put things in perspective. The governor's budget did not create any real health care cost savings, but rather shifted ways and who was ultimately paying for these services. ultimately hospitals have been forced to shift costs to other payers. Because rate cuts continue in the future, and unless we, unless the legislature takes action to reduce at least a portion of the previously imposed hospital cuts, payments to hospitals for 2008-2009 biennium will be further reduced by $235 million. And just very quickly, before we get to testimony, I will just point out to you that this bill seeks to address ratable reductions from 2002. That was a 0.5% fee-for-service inpatient MA rate cut. In 2003, it was 6%. And actually, I think I'm mistaken on my numbers there. But and then a further reduction in 2005 of 6%. Because of the matching federal dollars, because of the realities and challenges that we're facing as we work to achieve our targets and consider the limited revenue that we have available, we decided to focus on that portion of those ratable reductions that are eligible and can work collectively with some federal matching dollars. And so we're really seeking, while the problem is even larger than what sits before you today, at the same time, it was my intent and with the indulgence of the people surrounding me today, we also wanted to try to offer a package that we felt really served to maximize the limited resources that we have. And with that, I would like to introduce first James Hanko, who joins us today from Bemidji. Mr. Hanko.
Madam Chair and members, as introduced, I'm Jim Hanko, and I'm the CEO at North Country Health Services in Bemidji, Minnesota. North Country Health Services is a 116-bed hospital facility. In addition, we also operate a 78-bed skilled nursing facility called Nielsen Place. We have over 800 staff members, care for 6,000 individuals on an inpatient basis per year, and average 22,000 emergency room visits each year. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and its 135 members, I'm here today to thank Senator Lynch and the bill's co-authors to express our strong support for Senate File 635. This bill proposes, as noted, effective July 1st, 2007, to end a portion of the hospital rate cuts, which were taken in 2002, 2003, and 2005. As noted, these rate cuts are cumulative and, when added together, represent an 11.5% cut to our hospital payment rates when serving patients on an inpatient basis. And as noted by Senator Lynch, this has accumulated to over $290 million. These cuts were not one-time cuts, but continue on into the future. If state legislators do nothing this year to reduce any of the rate cuts, hospitals will incur $235.6 million in payment reductions in the 08-09 biennium. This legislation would end about 40% of the cuts that have been made to hospital reimbursements, ending the cuts in the medical assistance fee-for-service program. Cuts would remain in place for payments when serving individuals in the prepaid medical assistance program, PMAP, the General Assistance Medical Care, GAMC, program, and in Minnesota Care. Simply stated, the more patients a hospital serves in our public health programs, the more the hospital has been hurt by these budget cuts. For North Country Health Services, 22% of our revenues are from serving patients in Minnesota public health programs. As a percentage of our patients, we are the largest provider of medical assistance, general assistance medical care, and Minnesota Care outside of the Twin Cities. To further illustrate, and I've got my testimony here for handout if you'd like to refer to it, we recorded over 1,000 births last year. That's a large number for a small hospital in the community our size. 51% of our customers, the births were for medical assistance eligible beneficiaries. Another 8% were Minnesota Care beneficiaries. If you have a picture of where Bemidji is, you know, where the Mississippi River starts, we had deliveries on behalf of patients coming from as far east as Cloquet, 140 miles, as far north as Baudette, 104 miles, as far west as Monoman, 60-plus miles, and Park Rapids. And as you know, we're between three Indian reservations, and we do almost all of the deliveries on behalf of Red Lake and Cass Lake Indian Health Service reservations. To date, direct payment cuts to North Country Health Services have totaled over $5.1 million. And we are estimating that if the legislature does nothing this session to eliminate even a portion of the rate cuts, we will experience a loss of $4.2 million in the 08-09 biennium. These cuts don't reflect reductions which have been made in public health program eligibility, which have dramatically increased our charity care and bad debt expense. This situation isn't sustainable. It's very difficult in a community like Bemidji with few very large private employers and a high level of poverty, one of the highest in the outstate, to cost shift to other payers. Payments for serving those in our public health care programs need to be closer to the costs we incur in providing those services. We estimate that we receive about 82 cents for the dollar of cost we incur providing medical assistance care on an inpatient and outpatient basis. Because of the dollar-for-dollar federal match in the medical assistance program, whatever lawmakers can do to end at least a portion of the cuts that have been made, it will be very helpful to the hospital community, and particularly Bemidji, I would say, and the patients that we all serve throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for coming down. Are there any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hanko, I'd just like to personally thank you for making the trip from Bemidji. You know that we've had many conversations about this very issue. And I guess I would just reiterate the problems that a hospital like Bemidji faces, and the fact that if we don't do something about this issue, from my discussions with small businesses in our community, it's going to be an increasing problem, because there are a number of businesses that may be dropping private health insurance because they can't afford to continue to cover the increasing rates, so that this is just going to be a growing problem if we don't get on top of it.
Thank you. You want to continue?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have Mary Krinke with the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I just want to share with you all a couple visuals that just highlight the same information that Senator Lynch and Jim Hanko shared with you. I'm not going to take a lot of time. There's two other testifiers, and I know you all have a very lengthy agenda in a short time period. I just want to show you the bar chart that was included in your packet, and I think this chart puts sort of a visual picture on what they have shared with you today. The cuts that were made during the 2002 session are in purple. The cuts that were made in the 2003 session are in burgundy. The GAMC cut was a 10% cut in 2003. And then the 6% inpatient cut in 2005 is in light blue. And was mentioned today, these cuts are cumulative, so they pile on top of each other. And the little break in the chart here, the ones on the on this side of the chart, are the cuts that have been made to date. And if the legislature does nothing this session, the cuts for 08 and 09 will total $235 million. So this is just a visual of the cuts that have taken place to hospitals as the state has balanced its budget. The second handout that is in your packet that we prepared is called Helping Our Hospitals Help Their Communities. And we have prepared a pie chart that shows the percentage for each state program and the percentage of cuts that have been made. And as you can see from this pie chart, 39% of the cuts have been made in the MA-PMAP program, 7% of the cuts were in the GAMC program, 14% of the cuts were in the Minnesota Care program, and 40% of the cuts were in the MA fee-for-service program. What Senate File 635 proposes to do is to eliminate the portion of the cuts that have occurred in our MA fee-for-service program. And the reason we took that approach, as was mentioned before, regretfully, the GAMC program has no federal matching dollars. So we don't get the bang for our buck by buying back the cuts there. In the Minnesota Care program, I know legislators are struggling very hard this year to try to expand access and eligibility in our Minnesota Care program. So it's kind of counterproductive. We want to expand access and eligibility. So if we bought back the rate cuts in the Minnesota Care program, we potentially could be keeping people out of eligibility. So, and on the PMAP program, that is for medical assistance that is operated by our state health care plans, and each hospital negotiates with the health plans on what rate they will be paid. So it's not necessarily a direct ending of the cuts. So we thought we would focus our efforts on the MA fee-for-service portion of the rate cuts that have been imposed. Obviously, we'd like to get rid of all the rate cuts, but it's quite expensive, and so we thought we would focus our efforts on the MA fee-for-service portion of the rate cuts. So that's all I wanted to share, with the committee, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Krinke, the chart that you've handed out, does it reflect for 09, the rebasing of the hospital rates?
Madam Chair, these charts were prepared based on the November forecast. So the November forecast does not include all the rebased rates, right. Is my understanding.
Right. And my understanding is that it's, well, we'll ask the department to come up when you're done, and but it's a chunk.
Yes,
not insignificant.
Madam Chair, if I may, even with the rebasing brought the hospital rates up to 2002 costs, and then the 11.5% rate cut is applied to that new rebased rate.
Right, so that is true. That it does not remove the cuts, but it does infuse some more money into the hospital system. Okay,
Madam Chair,
Senator Prettner-Solon,
Ms. Krinke, help me understand this chart. So I'm surprised that I didn't know this, but so we had 0.5% cut in 2002, 5% cuts in 2003, and additional 6% cuts in 2005?
Correct.
Wow.
And Senator Prettner-Solon, just to refresh your memory, because you were on the conference committee, those cuts were not made by the Senate going into the conference committee.
It's what we saved.
It is what we ended up having to do in the conference committee in order to pay for a COLA that we didn't actually have a target to meet once we were in conference committee. COLA for long-term care.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Krinke, we then are recapturing all the fee-for-service MA payments after 2002. I mean, we're going back to 2002.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, this bill does not go back and recapture any of the cuts. It sunsets the cuts July 1, 2007. So we're not getting any of this money back. The bill proposes to sunset the rate cut.
Okay, I understand. All the rate cuts.
No, the medical assistance rate cut.
Yes.
Not the general assistance medical care rate cut.
Yes. Or PMAP.
Or PMAP, just right. Fee-for-service medical assistance.
Yes. Madam Chair and Ms. Krinke, how does this affect, then, county-based purchasing? Is that considered fee-for-service?
No.
It is not.
That's part of the PMAP system.
So how much actual fee-for-service MA payments are out there?
Most of the fee-for-service payments are made for people who are disabled.
Most of the higher expense disabled and cases are in the fee-for-service, and the PMAP is generally perceived as a healthier population, Madam Chair.
Although it does include now all of the elderly statewide.
PMAP does now.
Any other questions? Let's keep moving here. We haven't got a lot of time.
Madam Chair, we'll keep moving, and I assure you that my testifiers will be brief. Enough.
Right, and we have one more testifier for you that you don't have up there yet.
All right,
so.
And at this time, I'll introduce Mark McAfee. Mr. McAfee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee with AFSCME Council 5. We represent a number of workers in some of the larger hospitals in town here, Regions, Hennepin County Medical Center, Fairview University Hospitals, for example. Also, our sister council, 65, represents folks in a number of the smaller community-based hospitals around the state. And we're pleased to support this effort. If one goes back, many of the people in the room were here. If we go back to 2002, 2003, 2005, I know the there were countless hours spent in the that, you know, we thank the chair for at that time trying to hold together Health and Human Services. Some very difficult decisions, as you just mentioned, were made. And I think we have to remind ourselves at this time that the while supposedly we have a budget surplus and the $4 billion were made up at that time, it was partly by doing so on the backs of the hospitals and others. So we would just say that at this time we know that there's a lot of competing interests, and we certainly support nursing homes and other areas, but we'd suggest we this year you need to do something for the hospitals going forward. So with that, I would thank you.
Any questions?
All right. Madam Chair, I also have Mike Harris-Stahl with me. Mr. Harris-Stahl.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I'm an associate administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. Appreciate the chance to speak. Very supportive of the bill. You've got a copy of the remarks that I was going to make, I think, to get right to the punchline, if you will. The bill is very important to Hennepin County Medical Center. In 2006, we will lose from operations about $38 million. The bill would restore $11 million in payments to us, so that will certainly help. The one comment I would make, a little different, yes, we need the money, but institutions like HCMC working very hard on being good stewards, evidence-based medicine, electronic health records, doing things we can to be very efficient in the delivery of healthcare services, and this will help us as we make those transformations. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think that this is a crisis. I really do think this is a crisis. I come from southern Minnesota, Mankato area. And if there is one thing that was talked about the most when I served on the board of directors for the ISJ Mayo Health System, it was this problem and what happens in terms of transferring the costs over to the private pay person. And I was just wondering, in your discussions about this, because I'm looking at the fiscal note and I'm looking at thinking about some of the realities that are out there, if you had considered any other, this is a sunset, this is a complete sunset that has then an accumulative effect also in the future on our budget. So did you consider something in between, a total sunset or a reduction in these costs to restore the rate?
Senator Lynch?
Senator Sharon, Madam Chair. We considered a lot of different options as we put this together, and quite honestly, in one of our earlier versions of this, as we were working on it, this bill was quite large. And as Senator Pretner Solon has pointed out, this addresses a portion of a much larger problem. And I think that the way, by design, the way this bill is laid out, I wanted to clearly illustrate that there's a menu of opportunities here, the 2002, the 2003, and 2005. And like all of you. I'm painfully aware of the financial constraints and the limited resources that we have. And I do believe, as my testifiers do also, that in our discussions, the bottom line was we were really looking at what is the most cost-effective way, the most cost-effective approach that we can bring to the committee to address what is a very costly and large dilemma.
Right. I think you've done a good job with that, Senator Lynch. I mean, members, if you look at the fiscal note, the bill spends, you know, $16 million and then $23 million, which, of course, we don't have. But if we did, it generates, you know, the total MA dollars generated $56 and $59 million. So it pulls down the federal funds that we lost when we made these cuts. But everything is scalable, almost. Not quite, but almost everything in this committee is scalable. So
thank you, Senator Berglund.
thank you very much. I just I have another issue, of course, in terms of how hospitals are reimbursed and the differential that happens between some hospitals over other hospitals. And I'm concerned that this is a significant number, but I'm wondering, I think we should be clear that the benefits to this are not equivalent for a hospital like in Mankato as it would be for HCMC or Fairview. If this proceeds, it resolves issues for Children's and Regions and HCMC at a higher level than it would for the rural hospitals. And I think that any solution that we have to this has to be combined with concern for some of those other hospitals that are also suffering under the weight of the cost of acute care services.
Well, Senator Sharon, it's kind of hard to pay you if you don't have a medical assistance patient.
But that's not the case. I think that all of that needs to be really taken a look at again. I'm not saying that there isn't a huge need here, but the adjustment needs to take into consideration the fact that any changes that we make in reimbursements have to take into consideration some of the smaller hospitals in the rural area that are reimbursed at a differential rate.
Well, the really small hospitals have an increased rate on their medical assistance over all the other hospitals, actually.
Critical access. The critical access.
Yes.
But ISJ Mayo Health System in Mankato is not a critical access, and it is a regional hospital that serves a number of persons who are in these programs. So
whatever medical assistance clients they have on a fee-for-service basis, they would be paid at a higher rate under the bill.
Yes, but not at the major. There's a differential between how Hennepin County Medical Center is reimbursed for medical assistant patients in ISJ.
Well, this is the bill we have before us. any other questions for Senator Lynch? We do have one more person who wants to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard. I'm here today on behalf of Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. I'll try not to overlap with any of the previous testifiers' testimony, but this bill proposes to end, obviously, by July 1st, 2007, a portion of the hospital rate cuts, which were instituted in 02, 03, and 05. These rate cuts have been cumulative and when added together represent 11.5% cut to our hospital payment rates when serving patients on an inpatient basis. Overall, Children's, my client, and our friends at Gillette absorbed almost 16% of the overall MA cuts as a result of the 03 and 05 budget cuts. That's three hospitals out of 147 in the state of Minnesota. We continue to see a steady growth in the number of MA-eligible patients at our hospital. Most recent data even shows that 37% of our revenues are now derived from MA payments, up from 26% just 6 years ago. Cuts to the MA system combined with payments that don't come close to covering our costs and the growth in our MA payer mix is quite simply unsustainable. The cuts in medical assistance payments have been particularly hard on children's hospitals because we serve a disproportionate number of children in the medical assistance program, children from every corner of the state. At Children's Hospital and Clinics in Minnesota, 49% of our beds are for critical care and 37% of our payer mix, which I mentioned earlier, is for medical assistance programs. To date, payment cuts to Children's total over $32 million. This has had a negative impact on service delivery and precluded us from implementing a number of patient programs and delaying in desperately needed capital cost improvements. Because of the volume of patients we serve in the medical assistance program, about 16% of the total cuts to hospitals have been borne by these three hospitals, Children's and Gillette. The more patients a hospital serves in Minnesota's public health care programs, the more our hospitals have been hurt by the budget cuts. Without some increase in reimbursement rates, Children's is projecting $20 million in costs over payments for serving individuals in our public health care programs in 2007, and that factors in rebasing. Simply stated, the current situation, as I stated earlier, is not sustainable. Because of the dollar-for-dollar federal match in medical assistance, whatever lawmakers can do to end at least a portion of the cuts that have been made will be very helpful to us, especially the Children's community and our friends at Gillette. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Okay, if not, I'd like to ask Mr. Olson, maybe, if he can come up and just help fill us in a little bit about how much rebasing would affect this chart that we've been looking at today.
Madam Chair, Paul Olson, Department of Human Services, Payment Policy Area. I'm not familiar exactly with that chart, but based on the conversation, if it was based on a November forecast, rebasing was in, and always is, 09, all those would be in the forecast. One note, though, the November forecast carried the January 07 rebasing at a much lower percent than actually occurred after the button was pushed. We ended up with a MA 26% increase effective January 1 and about a 24.5 GAMC increase effective January 1. So their rates literally overnight changed by those percentages. The forecast itself had carried quite a bit less than that.
So do you know the total dollar amount that increased in the latest forecast due to rebasing?
I don't have that exact number, no.
But I thought it was $69
million. Substantial.
Any questions? Well, we will hear about it when we do the forecast overview next week. So, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, thank you. In closing, I'd just like to thank Senator Sharon for her question. And again, this bill, supports good public policy, moves us in the right direction. As Senator Sharon has pointed out, this is one component of a much larger issue. And the bill is not in any way meant to minimize the very real situation that we face. With that, Madam Chair, I would ask the committee's support of Senate File 635, and I would move that the bill be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion.
You have heard the motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I think at this time I am going to, it's pretty clear we're not going to get through the whole agenda today. And so I think, Senator Coring and Senator Olson, that we will take your bills that are on the agenda for today. We'll take them up next week.
Madam Chair, my bill would probably take about 2 minutes.
Well, then we'll see if we have 2 minutes when we
are. And then, Madam Chair, the Republicans are caucusing at 10:30 before session. So
Democrats are at 10.
10.
Well,
10:30.
We are adjourning at 10.
Oh, okay, we are. Oh, okay. I didn't
know. That's why I think we won't get through the agenda.
Oh, okay. Fine.
But
fine.
But you have unpaid lobbyists here today, so we'll take your bill next.
Thank you.
Oh, I know. This is another wonderful thing. This is another wonderful thing. That's okay, Miles.
I do see that you have an amendment.
Yes, I do. Thank you. I have an author's amendment, A1.
Senator Laurie moves the A1 amendment. Those, are there any questions? If not, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Now, be as brief as you can, folks.
Yes, I know we have a full agenda and very short time. Let me tell you a little bit about Senate File 676, the Remembering with Dignity Project. It's really about recognizing people with disabilities with the dignity and respect that they deserve. In Minnesota State Hospitals, on the state hospital grounds over the years, there have been over 12,000 residents that were buried without proper markings on their graves. These are range from cement blocks with numbers stamped in them to stakes with a number or none at all in some instances. And Remembering with Dignity is led by people with disabilities, some of them former residents of the state hospitals. And in addition to trying to get proper headstones and markings on graves, they're also working to maintain the grounds of these graveyards and make them accessible for people. There is a little bit of a personal part of this. I grew up and spent some time over at the state hospital in Moose Lake visiting with the residents there and know full well that the state was these people's family. And we need to make sure that we treat them with the dignity and respect that they deserve. And we've got an opportunity here to right a historical wrong. And I think that it is a moral imperative that we do this. The bill is asking for $400,000 in the next biennium to continue the work of the Remembering with Dignity Project. And I will invite some of the testifiers here, the unpaid lobbyists or volunteers, if you will. Gloria Steinbring?
Yes.
Yes, would you care to say something about this project?
Welcome, Gloria.
Was one of my dreams. I have visited the institution with numbers, and I started to cry because I wanted them to have their names and not numbers. How many of you in this room would like to be buried with numbers? None of you. Well, I won't want to be buried with a number. I want to be buried with my name. This is my dream, to see all institutions, former residents that have died there. I want to see that they have their name, date of birth, and date of death. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you, Gloria.
Thank you, Gloria. Jim Fassad, Carmen, briefly. We'll go right to Manny Steinman.
Good morning, everybody. How you doing? I'll throw my good mornings in real quick. Yeah, I used to live at the Faribault State Institution down in Faribault, Minnesota, and I lived about a block and a half from the gravesite down there on East Side Cemetery. And I lived down there from the age of two. I moved down there from the age of two until 1968. I lived down there for about a little over 8 years. And I'm trying to talk. I'm sorry. I've learned, through living down there, the skills and the stuff that I had to learn, to live on my own and be a part of the Remember with Dignity. I just joined on with this about a little over 4 years ago with Jim, and I'm real grateful to be a part of this, this organization. And I'd rather have people, just like Gloria was just saying just moments ago, I'd rather have people with their names, date, date of birth, and the date of, they're no longer with us. And I would prefer that than having numbers. And that way the people can go see their loved ones at their leisure or at their convenience.
Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we just keep going here?
One more quick one. Earl Karskis.
My grandfather was Jacob Karskis, and he's buried in the Hastings Asylum Cemetery. I learned this a little over a year ago while I was sitting in a friend's house three blocks from the institution and a little over a mile from where he's buried. My family had no knowledge of what had happened to him. He was institutionalized 1 month before my dad was born. I learned a few facts about him since then. Before he was institutionalized, he was a trustee in the church that he was a member of. I know that he had value and he had worth, and that I'm sure that my grandmother didn't have any idea what to do about this information, and she chose not to reveal this to anyone in my family. But last October, Remembering with Dignity placed a marker at my grandfather's grave. Since I had learned of what had happened to my grandfather, my desire has been to honor him and to just do whatever I could to remember him. And he was forgotten by his family. He spent the last 11 years of his life in an institution. And then later on, he was forgotten by the state. There was not a marker at all at the gravesite. There are now four markers out of 901 graves there that have markers on them. My grandfather's one of them, so I hope you'll continue to support this project.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, we'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Any questions?
Gloria?
If not, do you want to make a motion, Senator?
I would like to move that that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Berglund, I don't know if you've made a decision, but I just wanted to point out to you that I do have a witness on Senate File 1380 who's traveled quite some distance to be here, a citizen witness. Okay.
I know it.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members, I do want to take, before we do the Gillette bills here, I do want to quickly take Senate File 842. And we've already heard testimony on Senate File 842. And so I believe we should just be able to do an amendment to it. And then there is some urgency in getting the bill to the Finance Committee if we want to not lose potential DSH hospital money that we could get. So, if somebody can bring me the amendment. Well, it's not in my folder. Mr. Chairman and members, the solution that we've come up with for getting this DSH money that we talked about not being able to get otherwise is that we will use general assistance medical care fee-for-service dollars, and that money will not be enough. We have a little thing like this in the folders for you. That money will not be enough for this fiscal year, but this amendment, and I move adoption of the amendment, the A1 amendment, will then allow Hennepin County to use their, or let us use Hennepin County's funds that they use for uncompensated care to make the rest of the state match up. Then what the amendment does for this fiscal year is just the reverse. It would use Hennepin County's money, and then it would supplement it with DISH with general assistance medical care fee for service money. And since we don't know whether we can use any other hospitals' uncompensated care money, this we know will work and will get us the DISH money for this biennium also. That's what the amendment does.
Any questions on the Senator Prettner-Solon?
So, Madam Chair, we maximize the amount that we can get under this then?
We do if we can get this bill passed very quickly.
Like now.
Right. And that's why I want to get it out of here today. We have to post a notice in the register before we can file our plan amendment. And we have to file our plan amendment for this so that we're going to see if we can capture money from starting from January. If not, we have to get it passed, and then we certainly will be able to capture money for the quarter beginning in April.
Any further questions on the A1 amendment? Hearing none. All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
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 Nay. Amendment is adopted.
So, Mr. Chairman, then I would move that Senate File 842 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay. Any questions or comments on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Nay. Motion prevails. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, then there are three bills on our agenda today that deal with Children's Hospital, the Gillette Children's Hospital. And just to remind the members that while this is now a private hospital, it started out being a state institution owned by the state of Minnesota, and it was created specifically for the purpose of treating and providing assistance to disabled and crippled children. And so it is a pretty special hospital, serves children from every county in the state. And at this point, their Medicaid outpatient rates are set at the 50th percentile of the 1989 charges, and their inpatient rates are 30% below cost. Their outpatient costs are even below that, and more of their patients are able to be moved into an outpatient setting. This is good for families, this is good for children, but it makes it much more difficult financially for Gillette to come out in the black, and they are no longer in the black, and that's why these bills are here. They are just different mechanisms for getting to the same goal of providing them some higher reimbursement. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to them to tell their story. And Mr. Deal, do you want to?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Deal. I represent Gillette Hospital in the legislature. And I want to just introduce the people that really know about Gillette. It's President and CEO Margaret Perryman and our Chief Financial Officer, Jim Hattican. Senator Berglund sort of stole my initial comment. This Gillette was established by the state in 1897, and we consider ourselves partners with the state of Minnesota in pursuing the important goal of helping children with disabilities. Originally, children with tuberculosis of the bone, then polio, then scoliosis. Now our number one area of diagnosis is cerebral palsy. Helping these children become productive citizens of Minnesota. And I think we'd start by asking Ms. Perryman to talk about the primary types of problems we see and some of the stories that she's aware of in this regard. What we're handing out a list of the medical problems that we see by frequency of diagnosis, a brochure that talks about our centers of excellence that deal with these problems, and an exhibit that shows our patient origin, which is from every county in the state, roughly in proportion to their population, and an exhibit that shows the places where we actually go to provide these services. We're located in 21 cities around the state. So, Margaret.
Thank you, Mr. Deal. Ms. Perryman?
Gillette was, as John said, founded in 1897 by the Minnesota legislature with an allocation of $10,000, and we were the first publicly funded hospital for children with disabilities in the United States. Children who seek our care have physical and functional disabilities due to genetic abnormalities or resulting from injury or trauma. If you see a child with crutches or a wheelchair in Minnesota, it is probable that they receive care from Gillette Children's. The clinical problems for which we provide care are uncommon, but they are devastating to children and families. We seek to decrease the effect of a child's disability using advanced medical and surgical care. The most common disability that we provide, the most common disability in children is cerebral palsy. This results from an injury to a child's brain immediately before, during, or after birth. Most children with cerebral palsy do have significant walking difficulties. In fact, many of them have to use wheelchairs. More severe forms can also restrict a child's ability to speak. Most children with cerebral palsy have average to above average thinking and learning skills. Gillette Children's mission is to provide surgery and medical intervention which will improve the ability of a child to live in their community, attend school, learn effectively, and be prepared to take his or her place in the world. In 2006, we provided care to 4,500 children and young adults with cerebral palsy. One of our patients, Chris, had many surgeries at Gillette while he was young. He recently graduated from St. John's University, is working in a bank in his hometown, and is engaged to be married this summer. He says that his surgeries allowed him to stand, walk, and fulfill his dreams, and he always tells us the fact he wrote a poem that Gillette has given him endless possibilities. Spina bifida is likewise of a devastating disability. While its incidence has decreased significantly with the introduction of folic acid and bread flour, there are hundreds of children and young adults in Minnesota who have this congenital condition. Children with this condition will most likely be required to use of a wheelchair because they are permanently paralyzed from the waist down, but they have average thinking and learning skills. Children with spina bifida require specialized care because their disability is often associated with bowel and bladder problems, as well as the inability to walk. With excellent medical care and love and support of their families, they also graduate from school, become employed, and join the ranks of their age mates in the world. In 2006, we cared for 681 children and young adults with spina bifida, like our patient Britta, who has received medical and surgical care at Gillette throughout her childhood. She graduated from high school, attended Northwestern College, is working two jobs, and had the wedding of her dreams in the summer of 2005. She continues to receive care from Gillette in our adult clinic. Just last week, a family came into my office to tell me about the care that they had received at Gillette after their daughter had had a ski accident at a local ski area. She had serious fractures in both her right arm and left leg, and her parents told them that they had no idea. Her parents told me that they had no idea that they would never that they would ever need Gillette, but they were so glad that we were here for their daughter. She had been transported by ambulance to a well-respected emergency room, and the ER physician recommended that she be seen at Gillette because of the extent of her injuries. The traumatic brain and spinal cord injury program at Gillette is the only accredited brain injury program within a 500-mile radius. In 2006, we cared for 60 children with brain injuries and 118 children with spinal cord injuries. Josh, one of our patients, was an aspiring gymnast. During an attempt to do a flip in his living room, using the couch cushions as pads, he injured his spinal cord and is no longer able to walk. His rehab at Gillette was long and arduous, but with the help of his doctors and therapists, he persevered and is now able to be very independent. He is an outstanding wheelchair basketball player and gets numerous invitations to speak to audiences about his injury and his decision to pursue a full life, even though his life is now very different. The physicians at Gillette have excellent reputations for children caring for children with rare and complex neurological conditions. In fact, one of our patients is one of only 50 children in the world with his disability. Gillette and its physicians are connected to the other experts who provide care to children similar to our patients, and they collaborate with them to find the best treatment possible. Along with the faculty from the Paul and Sheila Wellstone Center for Muscular Dystrophy at the University of Minnesota, Gillette cares for children with muscular dystrophy. In 2006, we cared for 174 patients with muscular dystrophy. Most commonly affecting boys, muscular dystrophy is a debilitating progressive genetic disease that leads to early death. With the efforts of our doctors and nurses, we can help improve their lives and perhaps even extend their lives. And meanwhile, the researchers at the Wellstone Center at the university are working very hard to find a cure for this disease. And they themselves are among the most advanced in the world in finding perhaps the cure for muscular dystrophy. So we really appreciate that relationship. Gillette Children's also has well-known expertise in the care of children with cleft lip and palate, deformities of the head and face, epilepsy, hydrocephalus, scoliosis, clubfoot, juvenile arthritis, Lyme's disease in children, and other complex orthopedic problems. And I gave you an outline of the number of children with each disability for whom we provide care. Our inpatient hospital is located in St. Paul. The St. Paul location also has an outpatient clinic, and we also have permanent outpatient clinics in Burnsville, Minnetonka, New Brighton, and Duluth. Gillette also holds mobile clinics in nearly 25 different communities in Minnesota, including communities such as Wilmer, Owatonna, Alexandria, and Bemidji. The cost associated with providing clinics throughout Minnesota far exceeds our fees. We choose to provide these clinics so that families don't have to drive to St. Paul quite so often. These long drives require families to take time off work, take their children out of school, and our mission is to help families cope with the incredible challenges of caring for children with disability. That's why we believe we need to be closer to them. Continued decreases in the Medicaid payments will put pressure on us to rethink our use of resources, and it may become increasingly difficult for us to continue these clinics. Because our care is focused only on the needs of children and young adults with disabilities, care is not available elsewhere for them in our state. Gillette provides care to children and young adults from, as we mentioned, 27, virtually all of the 87 counties, and we put a list in your packet of the counties and how many children in each. In 2006, we cared for over 18,000 children, and about 49% of our patients depend on the Medicaid program.
Thank you, Ms. Perryman, for that testimony. We appreciate your work. Mr. Hattican, I'm going to give you 30 seconds, if that's okay. I'm sorry about that.
Just the outpatient process. Yeah.
Thank you, and I will do what CFOs are supposed to do and just get to the bottom line okay. for you then.
Thank you.
49% of our patients are covered by Medicaid. We deliver about 42% of the care to those patients through outpatient modalities, and our losses are significant on the outpatient side. We estimate $3 million in 2006, going up to $3.5 million in 2007.
Thank you, sir, for that testimony. Senator Bergman, what's your preference? You want to lay all three of these bills over for possible inclusion?
Okay. Yes, we did this so we could get different fiscal notes and we could figure out maybe which one we could afford.
So do we want to take this all as one, or do you want to
I'll make separate motions.
All right.
I move that Senate File 1239 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, any questions? All those in favor of Senator Bergman's motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Bergman?
Senate File 1240 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any questions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Senator
Bergman?
Senate File 1240 one be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any questions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much. Now if we could take Senator Olson's witness.
Senator Olson.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is a bill, Senate File 1380, and it's just a very brief bill requesting $80,000 from the General Fund to the Commissioner of Human Services for the purpose of putting a mentor in the home of a family that has had a child born with hearing loss. And I'm not sure whether it's your desire to just allow the testimony of this one witness who's traveled quite a distance. I know our time is very short.
Why don't we take the testimony, and then we'll take the bill up next week, and we can have more time for discussion of it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate this and appreciate the time of the other members, too. We have here Tony Fairbanks, who is a deaf mentor who has traveled here from Faribault. From Detroit Lakes, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I've been working 4 years providing mentorship for families in the Northwest area who have a deaf child. Through the Deaf and Hard of Hearing series program, I was trained to be a mentor to use the National Sky High Deaf Mentor Training Curriculum. That curriculum design is for deaf adults to learn how to help families with deaf babies, to learn sign language, so that the parents are able to facilitate their deaf child's language development. And more specifically, the curriculum includes teaching and modeling early visual communication, that is American Sign Language and deaf culture. Beyond the learning of sign language, deaf mentors help parents see their deaf child's options and their potential for success. Deaf mentors are selected based on their fluency in American Sign Language and their ability to communicate easily with hearing families, their comfort with young children, and their ability to support family decisions. I would like to explain that basically hearing children can pick up language so easily just by hearing. They listen to their parents, their grandparents, family members, friends, TV, radio, all around them, while deaf babies are not able to do that. They cannot pick up English incidentally, and their parents don't know sign language. So the babies also don't pick up sign language. So there's really no communication there at the very beginning in their house. The ages of 3 to 5, it really helps to have a deaf mentor with the family so the babies can pick up the language before they go into kindergarten and school. The deaf education program helps families with language, and it is really critical of itself to have those deaf mentors in the home. There is one, I mentored the families of 1 3-year-old boy and 1 year-old boy. Their parents learned so much. They learned what to do to communicate with their children. That 3-year-old is now 7-year-olds, and he can sign so many words, and he can communicate with his parents very well. The other boy will soon be 2 years old, and again, his mother is so motivated. She signs really well and is truly able to communicate with her son. Her son knows over 25 words in sign language just at age 1. So having had a deaf mentor has made a huge difference. With no mentor, parents really don't know what to do to help develop communication with their deaf children. So I ask you to please support this bill so that deaf mentor services can be provided to families of deaf babies when they need it. And again, this is all over the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for coming. We're very impressed with your sign language skills.
Thank you.
And we'll continue this bill then next week, Senator Olson. Is that all right?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And so our meeting today is adjourned. Thank you, members. And we have an important hearing tomorrow on the veterans' home issue. So.